Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This feels strongly like a therapy session, and I hope you don't charge me.
Great, fantastic.
Well, you and I have been playing tennis.
Yeah, we have.
Which I really appreciate.
Several times, actually.
Yeah, so now you've seen the soul of the publisher of Racquet Magazine, and I've seen the caliber of a six-time Grand Slam champion, and we're a little different on the court.
Well, I mean, it's called 10,000 hours of what I did prior to you doing it.
What I like so much about the idea of getting to know somebody's personality and their soul based on the way they play tennis really factors into the conversation we're about to have. We're talking to one of the sort of famously most introspective players on tour, one of the smartest players on tour, a mutual friend of ours, and someone I think we're both delighted to have as guest of the Racquet Magazine podcast, Andreea Petkovic.
Indeed. I would say she's the most introspective, most interesting, smartest player that I've ever actually been around as far as not singly tennis-oriented. There's not one player that I can honestly say can sit down, other than maybe Vera Zonareva, who is very similar in some respects, but so well-read, loves filling her brain with the most interesting anecdotes, the most interesting stories, the most interesting people. It's probably one of the reasons why sometimes she doesn't win matches, because she actually is a little bit too smart for her own good. Her brain gets in the way, but she's absolutely one of my friends, one of my best friends, and a very good friend of yours as well, and we love her.
She actually kind of connects our worlds. You know, I'm a journalist. I publish Racquet Magazine.
Therefore, you have published now two of her stories in Racquet Magazine.
Exactly right. Issue number 2 and our current issue number 6. And I'm a decent tennis player. I played in college.
Indeed.
My orbit would not usually include someone like you, a luminary of the court, 6-time Grand Slam champion, a tennis commentator, one of the greatest doubles players of all time. And yet she's somebody who's connected the two of us because she travels in both those circles.
Yeah, I met her a long time ago when I was on tour. We became really close in the last 3 years just because I retired, so I wasn't so obsessed with myself. I was a little bit more obsessed with having a good time. And along came Petco, as far as just somebody who I just found to be so fun to hang out with. And I think she enjoyed my company just because I see things a little bit differently as well. And we have good banter and we have good fun.
And you're incredibly outspoken, which is why I wanted you to do this podcast with me.
A little. Yeah, you and I meeting was because of her. And obviously, you know, I find you two to be way smarter than me. So I always say pick your lane. Mine is not to be the smartest person in the room, because I'm definitely not. But yeah, that's the case with the two of you.
And I wrote Andreea 2 years ago to write and to be thus far our only tennis player who is a writer who contributes to the magazine, because I thought she was smart and she had something to say that would bring people into our world. And now here we are, and we're about to talk to Andreea in what I think is a pretty rollickingly good time interview.
Yeah, I'd say so. And I mean, we only scratched the surface of some of the stories and the fun that we are going to have in the future with our fashion correspondent to this podcast. But she is in France and playing in a challenger, which is sort of going down a rung on the WTA Tour to get some matches. But you'll hear all about that from her.
And if you love what you hear in this episode, please tune in every week, because we are making her, will be our fashion correspondent. So enjoy this interview with Andreea Petkovic.
Yes, I'm Andrea Petkovic. I'm 30 years old. I'm a tennis player slash writer sometimes, and I'm in the lobby of a hotel called Novotel.
Okay, first question. What is your default accent when you're drunk?
Mine or Petko's Renee's?
Petko's is, I'm going to take a guess on this one, and I'm going to say yours is English.
Yes, hello, I'm from London. That's my go-to. What's my go-to British accent when I'm not just like normal? When I'm normal, I speak like this. This is horrible, but I really enjoy doing it. I'm already cracking myself up, which is the most important.
That's a train wreck accent.
I think you waffle between French, Spanish, and then you eventually end up realizing that English is your default drunk accent.
Yeah.
Do you think that's because you secretly want to be British? Is it a yearning?
I want to be Cockney. I don't want to be British. I just want to be Cockney. I don't know. That's like my go-to. I sent my cousin had, it was my cousin's birthday last week, and I sent her a message for her birthday in British accents. I was like, hello, and she's Serbian. So we had so many languages to speak in, and I decided to go like, hello, I'm from London. Happy birthday from London. And I was in France. So this is like the most fun I have when I'm with myself alone in my hotel room.
That's the most fun you have in your hotel room by yourself. That is, I'm not sure if I feel sorry for you at this point.
Yeah. Renee, yours is German. Do you really speak drunk German?
I've been known to speak a little drunk German at times.
Why? Where did you learn German? How did you learn German?
Because I probably know a little bit ein bisschen German when I'm... when I was hanging around Steffi quite a bit, because I'd go to dinners with Steffi and her family, and all they did was talk German, and so I picked up on ein bisschen Deutsch.
How's her German, by the way, Andrea?
Renee always surprises me because she knows these weird words like Stupsnase, for example, because we Germans have a singular word for a little nose, which is Stupsnase, and Renee knows it, so she always surprises me with those little words, with those little gems.
So it's like she's from the streets.
Yes, but I'm... really glad that we all know which language is your go-to, Caitlin, which is French.
Thank you.
Care to elaborate on that?
Well, first of all, I'm from Montreal, so it's like this great tragedy of my life that I don't speak fluent French, which is why I want to, which is when I get drunk. I wish I did, and I kind of convinced myself that I do. And also, I had this really mean French girlfriend, which is where I learned most of my French.
Oh, that is not a good story.
No.
That is not a good story.
It kind of begins and ends there. She was just mean in French. And of course, I found this like limitlessly alluring, because that's what you do when someone doesn't like you.
Well, that's why I know Petko's little go-to is English, because she seems to find herself these lovely English boys.
Is that true?
I love English boys, yes.
Cockney?
And I would like to preface by saying boys, because, you know, they have to be under... a certain age, like under 30. I didn't say under 20, under 30.
Well, as long as they are really pale, really awkward, and really tall, it's okay for me.
So the face of an angel and the body of a 15-year-old.
The body of a very emaciated rocker, like Mick Jagger kind of look.
Wow.
Yeah. With the baby face.
How would you explain this? Why?
I really don't know, but it's like my... it's. I don't.
She likes to be in control.
That's not true. I mean, that's not true at all. It's just, I don't know. I listened to too much indie music when I was young, I guess. And especially Caitlin's favorite band, The Smiths. So
Christ.
That has scarred me for life.
You said last week that you have actually found the German version of the Smith band. Is that true?
Yes, I have. I have. Drangsal, he's amazing. He sounds exactly like The Smiths, just with German lyrics, which is pretty awesome. I wanted to send it to Caitlin, but for some reason she didn't want to hear about it. I don't know why.
I have a hard time with The Smiths, but the conversation we were having earlier about all the famous literary figures would be good in bed. I want to pick that up because it's actually a very nice transition into talking about your nascent career as a writer.
So you want to say I'm good in bed, or what is the...
I want to say that I dispute the idea that all of these misogynist writers who you love would be good in bed, but Hemingway might be.
Hemingway.
I want you to explain that whole theory.
Well, the premise is whenever Caitlin asks me, well, actually we talked about eras, right? Which era we would imagine ourselves to be in. And I really never thought about it. I just said there are just a few writers that I would like to go back to hook up with, right? So Hemingway was one of them, and David Foster
Wallace.
Wait
a second. I just have to stop you here. Uh-huh. She asked you what era you want to be in, not what era of writer you want to sleep with. Or was that the original question? Or did you just... She talked about writers, and you took it into the bedroom of being with a writer. Okay, carry on.
That's exactly my point. And I would still put my money on David Foster Wallace. I think he would be better than Hemingway.
There's zero chance that's true.
The tortured soul kind of thing has something going for them sometimes in like very light moments.
I hear a lot of caveats. I just think hygienically and in terms of generosity, I don't see him being able to be very satisfying.
To live up to your standards.
There you go.
None of you know my standards. They are very low.
This is very true.
But seriously, let's talk about writers and writing.
Okay.
I wrote you an email a couple of years ago asking you if you wanted to write for Racket, and you wrote back saying you were intrigued.
Yes.
Let's start there.
Well, when you wrote me that email, I was intrigued for a moment, and then I just totally forgot about it for a year or so, right? Was it a year? I think it was a year. And then I ran across that book, The Art of Rivalry, by an art critic, Sebastian Smee. And he had this four artist pairs, and he described their rivalries and how they basically, profited from each other, and how they would have never been or never would have become the artist they were without the other one, and that the breakthroughs in art sort of happened through these rivalries, and that really inspired me and sort of just made me think about rivalries in tennis and in sports. And so I wrote the first piece, or I contacted you first with that idea to write a piece about comparing those artists' rivalries with Roger and Rafa, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do I remember correctly?
You do, yeah. You had actually a couple of ideas. It seemed like you had been getting into this mode, which is what I think is so interesting, because you told me you had kept a journal, you'd been writing. That's the stuff that I sort of want to get at.
Well, that's an interesting thing, because I have always been writing. I never had a time where I wasn't writing. I just never was writing to be published, right? So it was always more for myself. It made my thoughts clearer. And it was also just an exercise for my brain. I did a lot of fiction writing when I was younger, just to sort of explore out of my comfort zone and explore my creativity, because I always felt a little contained in the tennis world. So I wanted to do something that was just comfort-wise easy to access, right? Which is your mind when you're on tour a lot and when you're alone in hotel rooms a lot. So that was always the easiest way, right? You always find a pen, you always find a piece of paper. And then later, obviously with computers and iPads, it was even easier to just sort of get into writing. So that was something I was always doing, just to keep my mind entertained and just get out of my comfort zone every now and then. So I just never thought about writing to be published. And when I got your email, that was the first time when I was like, I could actually write something so people will read it. Because I have never showed any of my writings either to anybody. I have never showed anybody anything. So that was like a wake-up call for me to be like, okay, let's polish everything you scribble down. Let's polish it and make it readable. Not only don't just write it down, but also make it readable for people to understand what's going on in the chaotic mind of Andrea Petkovic.
Well, it was more than readable. I think it was really excellent, and people really responded to it that way.
I thought the piece was great, first of all. Secondly, I loved the bit at the end, actually, because I think one of the things that I urge everyone to read it, because it shows it more, it bottled down really to a little bit of jealousy, you know, and what people want from one another, really, and not sort of seeing what they're already really great at and embracing that about themselves. And I love the bit at the end where Angie turned to you and said, I'll never be like you, as far as the press conference is concerned. I don't want to tell anybody too much, because I'd love them to read it in Racket.
Right.
I love that piece, because, you know, you're always sort of wanting something that somebody else has, but you don't embrace what you're really good at. And one of the things that obviously you're really good at is entertaining people, including me and Caitlin on the regular basis.
So, yeah, and articulating your thoughts and expressing yourself, and she was looking at you sort of longingly and being in,
and vice versa.
In admiration.
You were constantly wanting to be having her results, et cetera, et cetera. But yes. Back to that mind piece, because you talked about the chaotic brain and your sort of chaotic mind. We know it well. explain why that's in some respects not great on the tennis court for you.
Well, the thing is, I'm equally emotional and rational a person, which might sound very paradoxic, and it turns into this whirlwind of emotion / thoughts in my head that just sort of carry me away. And I've learned to deal with it better with age, with experience. But I think everybody knows that feeling, that when you're at a weak point of your life or when you're just not at your best, those old sort of devils come back to haunt you. Those old devils and demons that you thought you got rid of, they just come back to haunt you. And I feel like when I have weak moments, I still get back into that mind frame, even though I thought I've had it all put away for a long time. But the interesting thing is about the jealousy part that you mentioned, Renee. What I always thought was very interesting about jealousy, that term for me was never a negative thing. I think for me, the negative thing is envy, when you wish something, when somebody else has something and you wish they didn't have it. I think that's a negative emotion to have. But to long for something that somebody else has might just give you a push to do something better or to change something about you. So I never really concocted jealousy with a negative emotion. For me, it was always something, oh, look at that girl. She's awesome. I wish I could be that awesome, right? I think envy is a really negative emotion where you wish somebody who has something didn't have it, so you feel better about yourself. And that was always something that I was very good at not having, thankfully, in my life. I think because of the education I had from my parents, and I have a sister, so we always learned to share very early on. But I think that was very important for me in this piece, to sort of make clear that people get carried away by jealousy, and instead of taking it and using it for a positive, just making it into this, or turning it into a negative energy and emotion that it really shouldn't be, in my opinion.
Yeah, well, that's why you're a rarity, because you do that on a daily basis. I've never met anybody who compliments anyone more than Petco. I mean, it's kind of like overwhelming. And I sit back sometimes and I'm always like, every time I see her, she's like, you look amazing. And I'm like, I can't even say that to her. And it's pretty much because Petco always looks amazing. But it's like, it just comes out of her so naturally. I'm like, you're just this abundance of like happiness, even when you lose. And I know how much you hate losing. And sometimes you'll go into your room for about 2 days and not come out. But yet you would not know that, because every time you shake a hand, it is always with love for your opponent. And that is, it's such a rare quality on tour. So you're a rarity. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think you have like,
thank you very much,
an empathy that comes across where you're actually genuinely interested in the people that you're meeting. I mean, I certainly felt it the first time that I met you, which is like, oh, you know, who are we? We're just some silly magazine people from New York. And, you know, having you come to one of our events in California and sort of like interact with the people who subscribe to our magazine just as a person was sort of notable, because I think a lot of people have guards up.
Right.
And I want to sort of talk about that in terms of, you know, you have empathy, but also the admiration. So instead of jealousy, even you could use the term admiration for Angelique Kerber,
yes,
which we were
you
just
talking
about.
You have an introspect that is rare.
Yeah. And I think, you know, that sort of leads us into the next piece that you wrote for Racquet, which was in the current issue that's out now, which is about musicians. Obviously, you have a lot of admiration for your fellow players. You have admiration for writers, as we know, also musicians. That's certainly something that you are drawn to. What sort of gave you the idea about going on tour? Because you pitched me. I wasn't going to catapult you into a tour experience, but you wanted to
yeah. Well, the thing is, I think Caitlin and I have this weird relationship of me texting you when I'm drunk at 3 a.m. with some weird idea. So I'm like, you know what? I think I should go to Siberia because the Pussy Riot members are hiding there and I think I should spend some time with them. And then Caitlin is like, oh my God. And it's like 3 p.m. in New York.
No, I'm
in
like,
the
that's
afternoon.
A great idea.
And she's with her kid. And then she's like, that could actually work. And
she
it was
could.
Kind
she,
of a...
You could have been with me at 3 a.m. in the morning. That is possible.
That's totally possible.
That is very possible, yeah. So that was one of these ideas. I was, again, reading a book. I was reading the biography, the autobiography by Carrie Brownstein, the singer of Sleater-Kinney, and now probably better known for her Portlandia acting and writing. She talks about this really interesting lifestyle about being on tour, where you have this very mundane moments and this routine days where you just sit on the bus all day and you load and unload gear and you're just practicing and sound checking and everything is super boring. It's always the same people around you. And then all of a sudden you have this 1 to 2 hour of high performance pressure and intensity moment where all the emotions and all the adrenaline and hormones just hit you right in the face, and there are people out there looking at you, expecting something out of you. And I felt a strong kinship to that, because I feel like that's what tennis, and especially the tennis tour, is about very much, because we have all these routines every day and mundane moments every day and spending a lot of time in hotel rooms every day. And then all of a sudden you have this match and emotions just hit you and nerves hit you and hormones hit you, and you have to sort of function. And I wanted to get into that and explore that similarity and obviously the differences also, and how musicians handle it and how musicians just deal with that, because I know how tennis players deal with that, but I wanted to have another perspective on the same thing that is yet different in its essence somehow.
And I guess I don't want to, again, get into like the crux of the story or the ending, but I think for me the takeaway obviously was the friendships that are formed on tour, even when you're sort of going through the ups and the downs and the good performances, the bad performances. But in the end, it's kind of like we're all a little bit of a traveling circus, and that's kind of how the tour is a little bit as well. And you kind of find your little niche group to hang out with on tour.
Oh yeah, that's very true. And especially a lot of people ask me, a lot of journalists ask me in interviews, like, Andrea, do you have real friends on tour? And I say, yeah, of course we have real friends. And then they go like, but you have nothing in common. What do you even talk about? and then I always go like, well, these friendships are actually somehow stronger or more like different than friendships you actually pick by interest and by maybe common interests, because those friendships are like people that you know from school, right? That you grew up with, and maybe you have totally different lives now, but it's like family when you see them, right? And that's what you have with tennis players, because you go through the same emotions, you go through the same troubles, through the same problems, and that forms a bond, if you want it or not. And you might have totally different interests, but there is something that connects you on a deeper level. And that's a bond that can't be denied. And so I'm always there. And I always say, yeah, I definitely have real friends on tour, even if we talk about, I don't know, the Notebook for an hour or so. Okay. I have not seen the Notebook. I just guess it's the Ryan Gosling.
Right, Pekka. I think one of the greatest moments on tour that we get is those moments in rain delays at Wimbledon. Can you give us a little insight, because I know I've been there with you in the locker room at Wimbledon when it rains, because it's the moment where sort of everyone's at the highest performance areas, right? You're at Wimbledon, you're at a Grand Slam, and it rains. Everybody, you know, is all in the locker room. Everyone's on a match, going to a match, or is sitting there waiting for a match. Like, and it could be 5 to 10 hours before you get on court.
And I can't imagine it's very big. Are people sort of on top of each other?
Yeah, I mean, at that stage, because everybody's in the locker room at the same time, right? So because everyone comes in. And you get that moment where it's a heavy deluge, and the loudspeaker comes on and says, ladies and gentlemen, the rain forecast is crap. And they don't say that at Wimbledon, but you know, you can imagine it's like, it seems that we're going to have hours of rain. So everybody in the locker room, all the players have this moment where they have this physical and emotional like downturn where they're not switched on. So now the natural sort of personalities come out in everybody, because now it's entertaining time, right? So Andrea is quite good in those moments. So, Petko, tell us a little bit about those moments and those, because I've been there with you, and explain that, because people have no idea what goes on in the locker room. Everyone thinks everyone's just a bitch and no one talks to one another, but explain those moments.
Obviously, when people are focused and concentrated on their match, they might be more introverted and just more for themselves. But as you said, when the tension sort of goes away for a brief second, the true colors show, and then actress Andrea comes upon us all. And I like to tell stories. I'm a storyteller, I guess. And so I start to tell stories about, well, we all have those stories about tennis lives and matches and whatnot. And then everybody starts to tell their stories, and it's always a lot of fun. But sometimes when it gets too long, I think, Renee, you've seen me in Wimbledon, I think it was 2 years ago when it didn't stop raining, and you came in from your broadcasting, and I was there, and I was like, I'm just thinking if I should hang myself in the bathroom or jump from court 18 on my head.
Yeah, that's actually...
I just wanted to kill myself.
Yeah, those were the exact words. Well, it was because you were waiting to play mixed doubles, or was it doubles at that stage?
Yeah, it was so bad, and we got cancelled literally every day for 5 days in a row, and I was just sitting, and we would be scheduled the first match on at 11:30, so I was on site at 10, and then we got cancelled at like 6 p.m., and I have for people who don't know it, the locker room in Wimbledon is in the basement, so you have no daylight.
Yes, you don't.
Like... So I was just sitting in the basement for like 5 days, 8 hours a day.
But it also explained the nature of maybe not wanting to play tennis sometimes when you're done with it emotionally and mentally at the end of the year.
I don't want to say it's like every other job, because there are a lot of emotions involved when you play tennis. And I think some people underestimate what emotions do to people. And when you have this whole year where you constantly go through highs and lows, and even if it's a great year, sometimes a great year can take away more energy from you than a bad year, because you're on a constant high, and no brain can really take being on a constant high. It's like being on drugs for
except Serena, she can handle it.
But she was born, she's different, you know, she was born to do that sort of, and I think the highs don't necessarily feel as high for her as maybe for us. For us mortals.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Speaking of mortals, I mean, you're top 10, right? Semifinals of the French Open, and you rock up. Where are you this week? Explain to people what happens when sometimes you have to claw your way back into that top 30 stratosphere and what you have to do on weeks like this. And explain who you were supposed to play yesterday, who also is going through the same thing that you are in some respects. I mean, how difficult and how interesting what people don't know about what happens on the tour. Where are you?
Well, I'm in the south of France. South of France.
Yeah, can we hear your French accent, actually? The response?
Oui, bien sûr, mais oh là là, mais ça c'est bon ça. And this is what all French people do, I feel
That's what you do when you're drunk.
That sounds a lot like my drunk French accent, actually. Go on.
Yeah, that's actually true. So I'm in the south of France in a little village called Cagnes-sur-Mer, which is actually beautiful. I'm playing 100,000, so I opted to play a smaller tournament this week to have a few matches and get back on track and get my confidence back on track. And then first round, I draw Ginny Bouchard. Who also had a wild card. Yeah, I got a wild card and she got a wild card. And we drew each other, which is funny because we both opted to play this tournament to have matches. And then we were supposed to play each other. Jeannie got injured, so she had to pull out. But, you know, sometimes it's just not in your hands.
Explain the difference, though, of this tournament.
Well, the difference is basically we practice four people on the court. We get half an hour of practice sessions a day. We get only three balls and no new balls. There is no water anywhere. Yeah, there is no water. You have to either
buy your own.
You have to either buy your own or you have to beg at the tournament office to give you. I speak French, so I can be charming if I want to. I can only be charming in French, unfortunately. So it has never worked for me in any other language and on any other country. But so. That's what, you know, it's just different. The courts are obviously, they only have three courts. So when qualies and matches start, there is no practice at all. And it's just very different, obviously. But I actually enjoy it. It's back to the roots. It reminds me of where I started and where I came from. And it really captures the essence of tennis. Everybody is fighting for their life, and literally fighting for their life, because you don't get paid as well, obviously, as on the WTA tournaments. And if you don't do well, you cannot pay your coach, you cannot pay your expenses, and you lose money day by day. So it's really, well, it's true, and it's really a different type of tennis when you see it. And it has been very interesting for me to watch. And actually, it's been good for me to be part of this.
Is it actually more intense on the court? Are the points more? Is it very cognizant that people are scrapping harder than maybe a first round at a Grand Slam where
Madrid.
It's 128 or something like that? Like, is it palpable?
Well, the thing is, it's at the same time more and less professional, if that makes sense. So what I mean by less professional, just like the...
No water?
Three balls?
Do you have ball kids?
Only on center court.
Wow. Okay. So there's another one.
Yeah. So the less professional, I mean exactly those things, like having a massage after the matches, stretching, training, working out like off the court. A lot of players I see here don't work as much out off the court as the higher ranked players, right? For example, just one example, yesterday when Jeannie pulled out, the lucky losers that could have gotten her spot forgot to sign
in. Oh my god.
Oh no.
So there was no lucky loser to get in, and that's why I got a
walk-off. Well, they saw they were going to play you, that's why. So they said, what's the point?
I don't know if that's true, but you know, but then on the other hand, when you watch the matches on court, the girls are fighting their hearts out. They're just crying, they are throwing themselves into the clay. It's really amazing to watch the intensity. It's so much different because, you know, the thing on the WTA tour is you get paid good money even if you lose, and if it's not your day, you're kind of like, ah, oh, fuck, this is not my day, I'm gonna try next week and I might do better. It's not that life depending, right? But here it is, so everybody is working so hard and fighting so hard, and the intensity is really palpable. It's very different. I think it's very different. I mean, same thing when you go around Grand Slams qualies, if you have ever watched this, it's very different energy and very different atmosphere than once you get to the main draws, I think.
It's kind of perfect for you, actually, because that's kind of you, who you are. I think switch the brain off and become doggedly determined, clay all over you, you know, the whole thing. So this could be, I feel it, this is your tournament.
From your mouth to God's ear,
yeah,
Renee.
I believe it. I believe in you all the way over here.
Okay, so now we're going to sort of do, we're going to try out a segment that we're going to call, I don't know what we're going to call it, Stubbs? No, I'm not going to be going to say that out loud. We're going to sort of ask the same couple of questions with the idea that we're going to try to get to some philosophical ponderings.
Okay.
And one of the best ones, and I'm going to ask it because it's Renee's question, the way she would phrase it is, there's a good lane and a bad lane on a tennis court. I think we all know what happens when you're in the good lane. But what do you in particular do when you're in the bad lane? What's your response?
What's your default mechanism?
Default mechanism.
That's not good.
When things are going badly?
Yeah, like basically when you're on the court and you know things are getting tough, what's your bad trait that you have to stay away from?
Well, except for crying and praying to God to help me out of the situation. I think the worst part that I do, or that works least for me, is I get really into my head because I feel like I can control things with my thoughts. So I really think about what I, like literally think about what I would have to do, which is the worst thing you can do in tennis, because you have to sort of go with the flow and feel it and just get free of thought and just be in the moment. And I think that's something that I do. I really think about what I could do better. And that's not good in my experience. I don't know. What's your experience, Renee?
Well, mine was to get a little bit crazy and sort of blame, the umpire or the ball. Somebody in the crowd made a noise, or, I'd have an excuse, or there would be a reason for me to have lost, And so rather than sort of just let it go and just move on to the next point, it was similar to you, but mine came out, my reactions were outwardly, obvious to everybody.
Right.
Yours is not obvious to people because you're introspective. You're going inside your brain, and I was going outside of my brain. So,
right.
So how do you change that? Like, what's the optimum place for you on a tennis court?
Well, the optimum place, and this is really difficult because especially for somebody that is as intense as I am on the court, I try to find a good balance between being powered up and intense, but still sort of calm. So kind of like an intense relaxation, if that makes sense, because if I get too intense, my muscles tighten up and I get really short in my swings and my strokes, and my ball tends to land flat and short into the court. And when I'm too relaxed, I sort of have no focus and no intensity, and I play. And the way I play is I have to grind somebody out point by point. So if I keep my level up for every point, eventually the others will break down. That was my strategy, how I win matches. And if I'm too relaxed, gift one point there, I play one mistake there, then I play a fine point, but that's not who I am. So this is the most difficult part for me, to find the exact middle ground of intensity and relaxation.
Yeah, see, I think I find you so interesting because you have such a creative mind, so yet you're a very pragmatic person. So the worst place for you to be is overthinking on the court.
Yes.
But yet then the creativity sort of bored human being.
Well, no, because if you're a smart person, you want variety.
Right.
Yeah, so you like all of a sudden your brain starts clicking over because you're actually thinking about other things and not really what you should be thinking about on the court, which is actually to stay loose. So it's like you have this like dichotomy on the court with your own brain, whereas one is overthinking and the other one is over creative. Whereas you almost need to, I always say to you, take your head off your shoulders and just throw it away for about a couple hours and just play with your physicality, right?
So, does that ever work? Do people listen when you give them that sort of advice?
Well, most do, but
I never do.
Petco's a little bit of the tough one to get.
Okay, we're going to let you off the hook. Related question. Do you think people sort of philosophically show you who they are when they play?
Oh, yes.
Like their personality, their core being.
For sure.
What can you tell by somebody's playing style?
And give us an example.
Oh, you can tell so much. Well, my favorite thing is when you can tell most. By now, it's a little different. On the professional tour, everybody has a poker face on. But you can tell the most about a person that you just met if they have never played tennis and you take them to a tennis court. You can tell so much. You can tell how determined they are, how proud they are, because pride shows a lot when you, and tennis is a difficult sport. Rarely ever somebody just picks it up and plays well, right? So it's a very difficult sport for beginners. And you can tell so much. It's like the most fun I have when I meet a person to bring them on the tennis court for the first time.
Have you played tennis with Caitlin?
Uh-oh. Where's this going?
I have not. No, I saw her play with Dave. But what type of person is she?
On the tennis court?
I'm just going to sit.
A little hectic.
Okay.
A little very aggressive, wanting to come into the net, which is, great as far as I'm concerned, because that was my gig. But listens very well. Takes information in very well.
Well, she's willing to listen. But that sounds like a real New Yorker. She's a neurotic freak that wants to learn and evolve. So that's like basically New Yorker on a tennis court.
Yeah,
that
wants to get better. Yeah, I think that's such a great, I agree with you 100%. You take, if you're a professional like you are and like I was, and you take somebody who has never been a professional and you take them onto the tennis court, in half an hour, I can tell you exactly what their traits are.
Yeah.
And you know what's
should
so
we do that for dating? Should we do that for dating? Like take the prospective partners out?
No one's allowed to date. I'm going to say this is the only married person in this conversation. Neither of you are allowed to date anyone without first striking a few tennis balls across the net.
That is going to be your prerequisite. Can you handle that, both of you ladies?
Well, I was just going to say the most interesting part for me is when you take a man to the tennis court for the first time and they play, and you really see, even like the guys that I go for that are not necessarily like the typical
sporty,
typical macho manly guys, but the masculinity comes out in them. They are super proud and they get pissed off if they can't do it, you know. And then the man comes out and I always laugh at them. I'm like, dude, you look like a 12-year-old girl. Why are you behaving like a man right now?
And then you keep dating them after that, or is that like the beginning and the end?
Of course. Of course. Four to six weeks.
Well, your German article that you released apparently says that you're not dating at all. So we feel sorry for you. Do you want to just, you know, tap out the end of this little conversation by telling everybody that you have no problem meeting people?
Wait,
back up a second. You are now a pretty well-known columnist in Germany. Yes, you're writing for one of the biggest newspapers. What is the gig? What are you doing?
Well, this newspaper approached me and asked me if I wanted to write a column. Or actually, they asked me if I wanted to talk to one of their reporters every week, and he would write something down for me. And I was like, wait, hold on.
Do you know who I
no,
am?
No, but yeah, I was
I'm
like,
published.
Who are you talking to right now? Wait. And so I told them, let me write this thing. And I said, so I sent them a few. Like Textproben, we call it in Germany, where it's like just a few test drives, and they looked at it and they were like, okay, we're gonna take this. And so they decided that they wanted me to talk about myself and pop culture, so which is a really weird sort of mixture.
Perfect for
you. It's difficult to describe because the column is about so much. It's mostly about traveling, hotels and bars, and how pop culture saves your life when you're alone all the time, right?
It's a good premise.
So, yeah. And so it's supposed to be every column, the anchor of the column is a film that I talk about in the beginning. And then I sort of make a connection to my own life. And the introduction to the column, I was supposed to write an introduction to the column. And it was supposed to be like, why films, right? So I was supposed to explain, because people know me as a tennis player. Why would I write about films all of a sudden? I'm not a film expert, right? So the road I went down was like, well, it's not always easy as a tennis player, and every person needs an escape strategy, and my escape strategy is films. So the original sentence that I wrote was following. So it's not always easy for tennis players with escape strategies, because alcohol is not an option, because recovery gets slowed down.
For some.
Then drugs is not an option because we are under strict doping controls. And sex technically is an option, but it's actually not that easy to get to as people might think on the road. I think that was the original sentence. So this huge gossip magazine took out that sentence and they made it into, and the headline was, Andrea Petkovic has no sex. And literally, in the first 3 hours after the headline appeared, my Instagram exploded into freaking maniacs writing me direct messages like, I have no sex either. Maybe we should get together. And you know what the worst part about this is? In my naive idealism, I thought, well, look at this. People really like my column. until my press guy sent me a screenshot of the headline of this huge newspaper that had featured the quote. And then I was like, well, off you go, idealism. It was not my column. It was just one sentence that I accidentally put in there. And that's how my life got destroyed and went down the drain in the course of 2 hours.
In the course of 2 hours, or maybe let's say a day, you got, just to take a ballpark figure of how many guys
50?
Tried
500?
To...
50?
No, you 5, don't 000? Understand.
Tell us.
Okay, so I turned off my phone because it got so bad for 2 hours, and when I turned it back on, I had 99 plus direct messages, so they couldn't even count it anymore. So I just blocked all, and then I called Renee to rant about this fucking newspaper and how they destroyed my social media for the next 5 days. And we talked for 13 minutes. I have it on record. We talked for 13 minutes. And in those 13 minutes, I had 86 new messages on my Instagram.
Wow. So basically, you are now officially, like, as far as Match.com or Bumble or Tinder or Raya,
celebrity
or whatever. Bottom line
that I don't
is,
even know about.
You don't need it. You just need to write an article in Germany, and you apparently could get laid every day for the rest of your life by these guys.
Oh. Every day, if I wanted to, I just have to, I just have to,
respond.
I just have to go on my, I just have to go on my direct messages and pick one, just like throw an arrow and pick the first one that, that comes out and be like, hey, do you want to get together? Because we both have no sex. And then they would be like, oh, okay.
For the record, you know, because I know you've wanted to square this away, but for the record, have you had enough sex that we don't need to worry about you?
I just want to say I'm fine.
Okay.
I just want to say I'm not lacking in any aspect of my life. But I also want to say the funniest thing is when I told the sentence, the original sentence to Renee, her first reaction was like, that's not even true. You do two out of three things every time you look. I'm like, Renee, it's fiction, okay?
You don't do the drugs part. I know that for a fact.
Artistic
because you
liberty.
Can't. But as far as the alcohol and the
extracurricular
activities
you're
with
fine.
The
you're
opposite
fine.
Sex, I can attest for fact that you are completely fine.
Renee, she's never going to come on our podcast again.
Yes, she will.
She will.
You know what the worst part is? People were like pitying me, you know? They were like, oh, poor you. You just
you're
can't
sexless.
Get laid, can you? Right? And I was like, oh, I'm okay, I'm doing fine. Don't worry about me. But no, this feels strongly like a therapy session. And I hope you don't charge me for this.
Mm-mm,
Not this time.
Not considering you have pretty much given me therapy for about 5 months thus far. But we won't get into that right now.
Well, listen, Andrea, good luck this week in the south of France. I can't wait to speak some French with you, drunken or not. Hopefully in
Thank
Paris.
You.
Leave me out of the
Merci.
French conversation.
You can speak German. And please come back on our show because we didn't even get to what you've promised both of us, which is that you're going to be our fashion correspondent.
Yeah.
Can I please be a fashion expert?
Give us like your best Met Gala outfits.
I have a good one, but go ahead.
But I'm very curious to hear your thoughts.
Well, I really like Blake Lively, I have to say. She always nails it, doesn't she? And
can I just say, you have gone immediately into fashion commentary.
Fashion
You're like,
mode.
Well, let me actually just start. Yeah.
Well, on the men's side, Chadwick Boseman, what's his name? I cannot pronounce
Chadwick
it.
Chadwick Boseman, he looked amazing. Mm-hmm.
He looked amazing. I really appreciated his look. And also, I liked how Rihanna really went full on with the Catholic Heavenly Bodies theme. And I also have to say that I found the theme to be quite controversial. Controversial, that is the word. Catholic, I mean, really, nowadays.
Mine was Lena Waithe, of course, who wore a big rainbow flag. Speaking of not being Catholic.
Oh, man, you got to gay it up, huh?
Yeah, she gayed it up. Like, have you seen her picture?
She gayed it up.
She gayed it up. It was like a big, big, big rainbow blanket over it. I thought it was great.
What we haven't talked about my favorite, because I'm a child of 1980 and my so-called life, Jared Leto.
Oh, really?
Oh my God, he looked like Jesus Christ.
I mean, he definitely has a Jesus Christ
Well, he kind of does look like Jesus Christ.
But he looked
Christ.
Amazing. I mean, he's wearing a gold crown. He sort of looked like very regal.
I mean, he went full on Jesus Christ. He was like, sorry, I didn't bring my mother, Maria Magdalena, to this thing.
I did love Tom Brady and Gisele Bündchen, of course. Like, I mean, those two, I don't know.
No,
they
don't
should
respect them.
They just want to put themselves on top of that trophy, don't they?
They're so gross.
Yeah.
They're the grossest.
His slick back hair. Mm-mm.
I don't want people that perfect in my life.
You're talking to two of them.
Caitlin and I took such offense to that comment.
Okay, and then lastly, this is sort of unrelated, but it is on the fashion tip. Did you see the female members of the Cannes jury and how they immaculately they were dressed? It's Lea Seydoux, Cate Blanchett.
Okay. Oh, I saw that.
Kristen Stewart.
Kristen Stewart.
A Ghanaian, I believe, singer, whose name I don't know.
Yes.
And then some men. And like the fact that the men were such an afterthought and not even in the pictures kind of makes it. Because those women looked amazing.
Well, Cate Blanchett.
They
hello.
Looked amazing. Well, they are just 20 minutes from me. They are 20 minutes away from me in Cannes. In Cannes. Ils sont à Cannes. right?
Very, très bien.
Apparently.
Bien sûr.
Yeah. Well, they look amazing. But I wanted to be like a weekly feature on the podcast as a fashion expert.
Fine.
But I just want the people to know that Caitlin didn't want me to be that person. And so that's all I'm going to say about it. And my emotions, my feelings were maybe
I'm
or maybe
editing
not
all
hurt.
Of this out because it's not true. I accidentally sent you a text to my best friend. You interpreted that as I don't want you to talk about fashion, when the reality is I want nothing more than for you to talk about fashion every week. Now we're going to talk fashion, because you have to say it in that German way that you do.
Fashion, fashion. We haven't told this story, but we have to get this in there some way. But Andrea, when you are stopped at, the border control of any country in the world and someone says to you, what do you do for a living? What do you answer them? You know, because my question, when I played, I would say, I'm a professional tennis player. I'm here to play an event, blah, blah, blah. Now I'm a TV commentator, an analyst. I work for ESPN, blah, blah, blah. Caitlin would say, you know, I'm a publisher. I'm a writer. I'm
sure.
Smart. I'm like, you know, I've got great feet. What do you say when someone asks you, why are you in New York?
Well, the guy that asked me this year, he asked me, like, what's the purpose of your visit? And I said, I play tennis. And then he laughed at me. And I said, that's a real job, sir. And then he said, whatever you say, ma'am. And I just went on my business.
So Petko doesn't say, I'm a professional tennis player, which is what you should say. She says, I play tennis.
Well, I do
Beautiful.
Play tennis. And I have glorious eyebrows.
We know.
Andrea, thank you for joining us on our inaugural episode. Hey, and thank you in advance for being our weekly fashion correspondent.
Fashion,
yes.
Correspondent. And I would like to say to you, vielen Dank, meine Freund, meine Freud. Freud? No, okay. Friend. Well, Freund?
Let's get her
what
drunk
is it?
And see if she can pull this off.
Freund, ich liebe dich.
Danke.
And that's it for this episode of the Racket Magazine podcast. Thanks for listening. Our host is Renee Stubbs. Our co-host and producer is me, Caitlin Thompson. Music by internationally renowned DJ Stretch Armstrong. Thanks to Tim Ruggieri, Taylor Dalton, and the team at Acast. Find us at racketmag.com/podcast and subscribe to us at any of your favorite podcatchers.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.